Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
To this poem, and I'll read it to you. It didn't make it into the copy there. A thatched hut buffeted by high winds. Who would dare come near? Blows of wind and shouts of moon keep away the mist and clouds. Solemnly I lift up my alms bowl toward the empty heavens. My unseasoned rice and minced yellow pickle will soon be ready. So, this was very interesting for me to read the poems by these women, and not for the reason I thought they would be interesting. It was exciting that there were women teachers back then, but more, it put me back into the frame of mind I was in at the monastery when I was training, because Edo Roshi had me working with phrases from these old classical Chinese poems. And he said, you can read the characters, so I don't want you to work with the translation. I want you to work with the original, which was, you know, one character at a time. Try to puzzle out the meaning and then check it against the translation. He said, because it's a totally different meaning than you will get just in English. And he was right about that. I had these memories of being up at 2 and 3 in the morning looking at characters and trying to get things done and memorized before I saw him in Doksan the next day. So, interesting. So I'd like to set the scene a little bit first. These are women teachers from the 17th century in China. And it was unusual for women to be recognized as teachers, as far as we know, because we have very little in the way of records, the records that came down are of the male lineage holders. But the particular historical circumstances in the first half of the 17th century in China, combined with the particular stage that Rinzai Zen was in China, combined to allow this to happen. So some women did train in the same way that men were training and became teachers, and some became Dharma heirs of male teachers and also of those female Dharma heirs. They also created Dharma heirs. So these poems that we were working with were all from that period of time. There was a lot of mixing between the upper class, the literati, and Buddhist monastics at that time. There was really a lot going back and forth, not just in China, but in Japan at the same time. It was a lot less isolated than you might think. So they worked together and kind of fed off of each other, the lay people and the monastics. And they did calligraphy, they did poems and essays, brush painting. Poetry was considered to be the highest art form, really, because in many ways it was the most difficult. And all of these people, both in the monastery who were doing this kind of work and the women and men who came from the literati, were all from upper class, pretty much. And which means that they would have been very influential at that time. And that time, the Ming Dynasty was beginning to weaken, and the Manchus were coming in. So If you can imagine this time where the native Han Chinese had taken back control of China from the Mongols, and that was the Ming Dynasty, and now they were beginning to lose it again to the Manchus. And so it was a very kind of difficult time in terms of national identity, in terms of if you were in the upper class, it was a good time maybe to leave the government and you know, retire to your country home and write poetry. And so there was a lot of that going on. And in fact, the father of this first woman did that. He had been a high-ranking official in the Ming government and decided to take his retirement when he could and went back home. But they were a very literate family, and this woman that we know as Xingang was their only child.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have a daughter, only child, but she was quite literate, she was quite educated, and she was engaged to be married, and then her husband died actually before the marriage ceremony was completed. She was engaged, but they hadn't exchanged dowries and moved her out. So still, she was somewhat obligated to that family of her dead husband-to-be. So even though at that point she decided she wanted to take up a religious life, she really couldn't leave home. She had her parents that she had to take care of, and also she had some obligations to these in-laws-to-be. So there was a lot going on for her. She actually had a hunger strike in order to force her parents to let her eat a vegetarian diet because she wanted to have that be part of her practice. She was quite serious. And they did give in on that. But she was just training at home and did that for quite some time until her mother died and she was able to take up the training more seriously. But this was another reason that more women could enter into training, was that with the wars that were going on at this time, plus disease, a lot of the young men that they might marry were getting killed off. And so there were kind of extra women around, either married or and about to be widowed or not married yet. And so there was this group of literate women who didn't necessarily have that lifestyle waiting for them. And women have always gone into convents there just because if you have no family to support you, that's one of the few ways you could survive in that setting. Although prior to this, the kind of the reputation that those convents had was a little bit short of a brothel. There was apparently not a real serious spiritual atmosphere to it. It was more like, you know, a place to stay. But these people were quite serious, the ones whose poetry survived. And I was thinking about why it is we know about them. We know about them because there's biographies of the women who became Dharma heirs. And then there's poems tucked into that. There's poems tucked into collections of the Dharma talks. And so Beata Grant was able to kind of tease all of these out and work with them. And some of what we've put together is really quite pieced together. So when this young woman took up the religious life, and she became a vegetarian, but she was studying at home and she was practicing at home, but then her in-laws she had to deal with, and she had been given a dowry. This is how it worked, is she was given money and stuff to bring into the marriage, and rather than keep it for herself, she used the dowry money to purchase land for her in-laws and said, this is for you, this is so that you will be able to have someone in your family stay and honor the ancestors in the family, which would have been her job as the next generation. She said, I can't do it. It's really quite a gutsy thing to do, to just say, here's, you know, figure it out. Here's something for you, but it's not going to be me. When she was 26 years old, when she actually began religious study, first with a teacher named Qi Jing, and then she fairly quickly went to one of the Rinzai masters who was working with the Huatu, which are the questions that form the kernel of a koan, the way we read them nowadays. It's a question that's like a, my teacher Genki used to say, it's like a can opener for your mind to open it up so you're not stuck in there, but it's open. Anyway, she got a huatu from Mi Yun Yuan Wu, who was one of the most important Rinzai teachers at the time. And he sent her home to work on it because her mother was still alive, and he said, your obligation is to be there with your mother, so here's your question, go home. And the question that he gave her is, where is the place where I can dwell in peace with the will of heaven? Where is the place where I can dwell in peace with the will of heaven? And so she worked on that for a while and couldn't come up with anything. She sat with this question, didn't really know what to do with it. So that was when she was about 26. And then her mother, when her mother finally died, she was in her early 30s, and she built a small hermitage and began going to a couple other teachers. She had that question, she couldn't figure it out. So she went to another teacher, I'm sure I'm saying it wrong, Ergong Qian, and he gave her a different huatu to work with. The myriad dharmas return to the one, but where does the one return to? She sat with that one for a while and didn't get that, and finally went to a dharma heir of her first teacher, Shuche Tongzheng, and he was Miun's dharma heir, Miun Yuan Wu. And she started training with him when she was 36 and worked for 10 years on her next huatu, which was, what was your face before your mother and father were born? It's a very famous koan question. 10 years she worked with that, had some small insights during a seven-day sesshin, just began to get an inkling of what it was. But then she finally went to see her teacher, who was having a Dharma dialogue with her first teacher over a simple version of all of these questions, which was just, who? That was the question, who? Genki Roshi used to say, work with who is it? Who is it? That was the way he said it. But who? And that just caused her to break open and get all of these questions. She responded, instead of the other teacher responding to this question, she just burst in and started spouting off. And the teacher recognized that she had some real insight, but sent her back home to train some more. At this point, she's in her 30s, late 30s, and she comes back finally to be tested at age 43 And at this point of testing, he feels comfortable enough with her understanding to make her a Dharma heir and gave her his scepter as acknowledgement that she was his Dharma heir. It's really quite something, at least in terms of what we know of that history, for a male teacher to give a female teacher that status. It comes in the context, though, of the fact that Rinzai Zen was being replenished at that point. It had faded out somewhat and been restored and then faded again, and now it was being restored again. And one of the ways in which they were restoring it was teachers were really working hard to acknowledge Dharma heirs. Some of them would have 12 or 20 Dharma heirs who were authorized to teach and pass the Dharma along. This style, both the questions and the earlier style of Rinzai, of yelling and beating people and just kind of shock therapy to get them to stop trying to think so much and stop getting kind of caught up in themselves. So these were the ways in which Rinzai Zen was being restored. And so between that and the unsettled nature of the times, I think it was a good opportunity for women to train and to enter in and become recognized as teachers. So Jing Gong was 43 when she was made a teacher. And this poem that we're looking at today is one of her poems. And you notice the title of it is "The First Month of Summer Retreat." Doesn't say the first day or the second day of summer retreat. I just suspect there's not a whole lot of poems written those days. I think people are just trying to get their sea legs and sort things out, and they're not in that kind of open-hearted place yet. So the first month, she's moved a little bit past the first or second day. "In the gates and halls of the elders, the work of the lineage flourishes. Knowing my own lazy ignorance, I've hidden myself away in order to be still." As Koshin mentioned last night, this is a really special opportunity for us to come together and be in silence and to practice together for an extended period of time. It's harder and harder to find this kind of opportunity to train. And even back then, you might think, well, they didn't have computers, they didn't have that kind of work. She was a member of the upper class, so she really didn't have to earn a living for herself. So pretty easy, right? But even she is saying, "I've hidden myself away in order to be still. I have to do it. I have to make that effort. Otherwise, I just fall back into my old patterns, my own lazy ignorance." So, "Esoteric methods, blows and shouts, I'm giving them all a rest. The myriad dharmas merge in emptiness. Stop asking about Chan." So all of these, the questioning, the blows and shouts, all the extra stuff that might happen in practice, in the name of practice, she's saying, let's just drop all of that and really just focus on the basics. So in this retreat, she set aside for herself simply to meditate. "A worn, patched robe hangs lopsided from my shoulders. When hunger comes, I will eat. When tired, I will sleep." Genki called this natural activity. He would use those words all the time, natural activity. Ordinary mind is another way we hear that. No thinking, just doing is another thing he used to say. if you were getting too caught up in your ideas about things, he would say, stopping now, no thinking, just doing. No thinking, just doing. So just be quiet. That was his expression. And that's hopefully what we're aiming for. Not there at the beginning of Sesshin, but because there's a lot of thoughts about what's going on, a lot of rules to learn. Seems like by the end of Sesshin, we have all the rules down and everything's moving really smoothly. And then we forget it all and have to start over again. And that's really okay. That's really what this is about. Sitting still on my cushion, I will completely forget the world and just let the days and months drift by my window. This is an example. These lines in Chinese are an example of how it's useful sometimes to be able to go back to the characters, because the characters that say days and months here could just as easily be translated sun and moon. The character for sun stands for day, and the character for moon, obviously, for month. And so those, both of those images happen when you read it in Chinese, a sense of the passage of time and also a sense of connection with the way that nature is unfolding. So the day is coming and then the night's coming, and we can see that out of the window. And of course, there's even more layers to it if you recognize that the moon is the symbol for enlightenment. And so perhaps in this case, sun is preoccupation with our daily activities, our worldly thoughts. So perhaps sun and moon in this case can mean more expansive understanding and more contracted, confused understanding. So there are many layers even in just those two characters. If you can imagine these poems as you read them, the pictographs, these characters hook into a lot of different layers of meaning. And they also hook into phrases from other poems, which when you recall those, all that nuance comes along too, and the stories come along too. We don't have that because it's not part of our cultural kind of background noise. But for these folks writing these poems, that was there. So then when we read that couplet, sitting still on my cushion, I will completely forget the world. I will stop thinking about it. I'll let go of it, right? And just let it all drift by my window, kind of like watching a movie. We have, we're engaged with it, but we're not caught on it, right? It can just drift past. Rising high in the cloudy peaks, a lodging for this illusory body, white clouds and green bamboo, one leaning against the other. So we have this image of a hermitage up in the high mountain, and white clouds and green bamboo, one leaning against the other. Visually we can see it, but it's really pointing to the importance here of having a felt experience of that interdependence of phenomena. You know, there's we might not understand how white clouds and green bamboo could lean up against one another. We don't understand that, but we can maybe feel it. We can sense it when we sit still and open to it. Sometimes it's propping each other up. Other times it's supporting or encouraging. Sometimes it's just acknowledging. But there is that interdependence, which we begin to feel more and more clearly and deeply as the week progresses. Before my eyes, this magical scene undergoes its transformations. Fastening shut my brushwood gate, my happiness spills over. Again, the brushwood gate is a symbol for that mountain hermitage. And it also recalls an 8th century poem, Wang Wei's poem. Our parting in the mountains now is over. In the evening, I close my brushwood gate. Spring grasses will be green again next year. But will you, my friend, return? Now, I just happen to know about that poem in some other context, but when I read that line, I thought, oh, that's that poem. She's alluding to that poem. So that sense of some things continue, the cycles continue, but other things change. I don't know if I'll see you again. This is the feeling that comes in when she says, close my brushwood gate. And then the last verse, a thatched hut buffeted by high winds. Who would dare come near? Blows of wind and shouts of moon keep away the mist and clouds. Here, nature is the teacher here, right? You don't need a person there to tell you about this. The blows of wind and the shouts of moon are there. And if we're open to it, we can hear that instruction. Plus, who would want to be up there with all of that going on? She said, there's not many of us who will undertake this kind of a journey. The wind and the moon keep away the mist and clouds. The mist and the clouds here are the things that obscure our understanding, the delusions that arise from us, the busy thoughts that distract us. All of this is mist and clouds hiding the moon from us. Solemnly I lift up my alms bowl toward the empty heavens. My unseasoned rice and minced yellow pickle will soon be ready. So from emptiness comes our true sustenance that we can rely on, we can depend on, that is not, we can't lose it. It won't go away. We may not notice it. We may not recognize it. We may not feel it. But we can't ever lose that. And this is a very poignant understanding, particularly in the midst of the political uncertainty that she and her class and family were experiencing at that time, not knowing how things were going to unfold. So whether we're alone or with others, you know, sitting in a solitary retreat in a hermitage as she was here, or sitting in a group as we are here, what we're doing is letting go of all these things that we brought with us, just to be able to sit, let things settle down, let things clear out enough so that we can begin to really appreciate and feel this underlying sense of connection, this underlying interrelationships, how we support one another. I know for me, I come and I want to get into Sesshin, and there's a piece of me that's thinking, can I just cut to the chase? I'd like to get through some of the fatigue and the settling in and the nonsense that I know is going to come up in my head at a certain point. And I know it's going to be there and it's going to come up every time and I'll get through it and I know all of that, but sometimes I just want to kind of hit the button and go to like the third day or something. That might be easier. So part of what we're called upon to do is have some patience and some trust in the process, and to just be open to all of that as it comes up. And it will bubble up and burp up like that for a while. And just really also recognize that those are precious moments. Even the ones of confusion, the ones of discomfort, the ones of distress, that is all part of this. It's just as much a part of this as the good stuff, so-called. So even though as I read this poem, I think, well, she's been sitting for a while. She's kind of, you know, in the groove, right? And I think, oh, wouldn't that be nice to get to that place? And we will. We all will get to that place to some degree, sooner or later, and just keep sitting.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.